Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden. Welcome to the Catchcast on Vectis Radio FM 104.6. Today we're meeting an architect and a designer whose work has literally been seen by billions of people. How did he begin a career like this? What goes into planning a public space? And how is he encouraging more people to take up such creative work? Welcome to the Catchcast, Andrew Mead.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're going to get to all your amazing achievements, but can we start by taking you back a little bit? What were you like as a kid? Where were you raised? What interest did you have in all this stuff?
Oh, I'm a South London boy. I was born in Brixton, and I think my interest in architecture and building, you know, like most kids, came from Lego and Meccano. I remember I was sick in hospital once, and my father bought me a Meccano set when I got out of hospital, and, you know, I got sore little fingers putting those little nuts and bolts together. I think at one point he probably hoped I was going to become an engineer, but I think the creative side of me took over, and eventually I studied architecture at Sheffield University.
Your university life, did you actually think, I'm going to be an architect, or was it just something you kind of felt you needed to do?
My grandfather had been a carpenter, so I think there was a bit of the building industry through there, and I think it was a bit of people at school were saying, you know, why don't you go on to try to do architecture? And I've got no architects in the family. Nobody actually went to university from my family either. So I went out there with no expectations, and certainly not having expectations of having a career in transit. Sheffield was a standard architectural education where you're doing the usual housing, schools, etc., etc. But not once did I design a train station at college.
And so how did you then get your first jobs? Where were you working to begin with?
So my first year out job was with a very well-known architect, Michael Mansour, who at the time was the president of the Royal Institute of British Architects, rather infamously sitting there next to Prince Charles at the famous carbuncle dinner of the National Gallery. And I remember going to work the following day with all the BBC outside the office in Hammersmith, trying to get interviews with him as to what the hell had just gone on. But it didn't resonate with me being a South London boy and then being kind of North London architects that were doing rather expensive houses for overseas clients. And about 4 or 5 months after joining them, I did something very unusual. I left that company and joined Design Research Unit, who, unbeknown to me, were the original architects of the Hong Kong Metro. But at the time when I joined them, I didn't even know about their transit industry. I just wanted a job that was a little bit closer to home, quite frankly.
And when you started to discover some of the history of DRU, did it interest you out of nowhere? I mean, they did so much great work with London Transport and with British Rail. They've got a fantastic pedigree. How did you feel when you started to realise they had all these historical connections?
It was totally inspiring. I remember going into their office at Lower Marsh, and from a graphic design point of view, not just architecture, they'd done the ICI logo, the Dunlop logo, the British Rail logo, obviously. There was such a heritage there. And it kind of resonated me on a personal level, because by this point, I was kind of know, you know, what kind of architecture did I want to do? I got to become an architect because I wanted to do public buildings. I wanted to shape cities. But I didn't know that in my first undergraduate year. It was really those final 3 or 4 months of my year out that I went, hey, this is my calling. I love the idea of doing public architecture, the buildings that everybody uses. It cuts across every demographic that there is out there. You know, people go to libraries if they're interested in books. People go to court if they've done something wrong. But everybody uses the metro. Doesn't matter, you know, young or old, rich or poor, it is the lifeblood of a city. And to be able to be the architect and the client for those buildings is absolutely a true honour.
So can you tell us about some of your first architectural jobs in transport?
So the first station I worked on is on the Docklands Light Railway. Being originally from London, it was a local project. DRU was already working on that. West India Quay Station was one of the original stations of the DLR, and it was being expanded as the Canary Wharf development was being developed, and it needed to be expanded to deal with the increased capacity. That directly led to my first overseas appointment in Toronto, Canada, because the Canary Wharf development was famously developed by Olympia in York, Canadian developers. And this is pre-internet, so you didn't have emails going around and connecting with people. But I met some Canadian consultants, and through making a few phone calls, I ended up in Toronto in 1992, working on what was called then the Rapid Transit Expansion Program. And that was when I really first stepped into a client side role, not a designer side role, and worked on the Shepherd Subway.
Now, you say you worked on it. I know that you later became heavily involved in the art side of things. But were you originally employed on the Shabbos subway to do art stuff, or were you doing the architectural side?
Actually, I was working on a completely different project. A project, actually, interestingly, is just coming to completion now, interestingly, almost about 30 years later, called Eglinton West Subway. So the rapid transit expansion program was actually to build several new lines, but politics got in the way. And whilst we started building the Eglinton West line, there was a change of government, a change of leadership, and they decided to cancel the Eglinton West project. And then the only one that was going to go ahead was the Shepherd Subway. Now, the Shepherd Subway already had an architect on board. So I was kind of like, well, what do I do? And I took over the art program. So Toronto already had an art program, like many metros around the world, London, Paris, New York, etc. And so I was kind of like given the task of like, OK, Andrew, you lead the art program now and work supplementary with the existing architect. So I did a little bit of the architecture, but all of the art program there.
And tell us about some of the installations that you were able to commission for Toronto.
So it was a very broad range, and we was very lucky that we had an art consultant called Rena Greer, and she managed to get us connected with some really talented artists. That's the first thing you need to do a great art, is you need talented artists. The second thing was a mother of necessity. We had no budget. So we had to kind of be very, very creative in terms of how to spend the money. And the third part of it was that the program was designated what was called an integrated art program, meaning that these weren't applied artworks that we'd make in a studio and then come and hang in the station. We had to use the architectural finishes themselves to be part of the art. So at Young Shepherd Station, we created a photographic mural based on photographs of Young Street, which is normally known as the longest street in the world. And then we recreated them in mosaic tiles all around the station. At another station, at Shepherd Station, we did a series of tiles where we had people write the name of the intersection on a piece of paper and then reprinted them on the tiles. And we used that like wallpaper all over the station. So being very creative around having little budget, working with very talented artists, created a collection of fantastic artworks.
And those are still visible today, because that's the great joy of doing art in public buildings like metro stations. Are there any particular ones you'd recommend people going to look at, apart from the couple you've mentioned? Is there any other ones?
I think my personal favourite, and is one I always talk about when I do lectures, is Bayview Station, where we did these anamorphic drawings along the walls of the station. So when you stand in one particular location, it doesn't make sense, but when you turn around, you see a related images. We use a lot of stepladders for that one, because they distort very nicely, and when you turn around, they resolve very well. And there's a very famous little dog that sits on the ground with his nose pointing towards the staircase. And that's a very important part of what I try to do with my artworks, is that these are not arts designed to be in an art gallery. These are art designed to be in a train station and helping with wayfinding as you go through the station, such as the nose of the dog pointing in the way of the staircase.
It's important, isn't it, that people don't just walk through blank spaces. It's important that they see something constructive along the way.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I've often asked, why do we do art in public transit? And I always answer, well, because we love art. It shows who we are. But the great thing about doing art in different cities is that it's an opportunity to show the culture and talent of local artists to the world, because tourists always use the public transit of any city they visit.
We're with one of the most important and influential designers and architects of the metro systems around the world. His name is Andrew Mead. We're talking in Hong Kong just after the Transit Mapping Symposium. Now, following your excellent work in Toronto, you moved to another part of the world, didn't you, Andrew? Where did you go next?
I always had an ambition of living on a tropical island, and what happened is I had a friend that I was working with in Toronto who had been working in KL, and she had got herself a job in Singapore and said, hey, they need architects too. So I packed my bags in January of 1996 and moved to sunny Singapore, where I spent the next 10 years of my career primarily working on the Northeast line, but then subsequently on many other lines, the Circle line, Downtown line, and a few other projects through there.
So it's quite a big and quickly expanding system in Singapore, isn't it? You must have been been very busy for that 10 years.
It was incredibly busy. And the great thing about Singapore is that they are totally committed to building a world-class quality metro system. But when I moved there, they'd already had two lines. They had a very small art program. I was in charge of the bottom half of the Northeast Line stations, the city centre stations. But I took upon myself to expand the art program. I made a case that for their art program for the Northeast Line, instead of just doing artworks in their city centre stations that they'd done before, that every station on the line should have artwork. It took me about a year to convince the management that it was a good idea. And then after they said yes, they just let me run with the project. And it was absolute dream time to work together with such talented artists and also talented architects and project managers. Everybody who believed in the project actually helped us make it realise and make it the project it is.
Now, can you describe some of the wonderful artworks you commissioned there, please?
I think probably the most notable one is in Chinatown, and it's also technically one of the most challenging. We worked with an artist called Tan Sui Han, obviously a very well-known Chinese artist who was an expert in the three traditional branches of Chinese art. He was a calligrapher, he was a poet, and a painter as well, and he actually created a piece that intertwined all those three disciplines for the station. So the station features primarily a very large mural that tells a story of the Chinese immigration into Singapore. And there's two crisp-shaped rocks by the mouth of the Singapore harbour that he paints very well. And then the story develops, and those Chinese immigrants are then portrayed with six-packs. They're like Adonis kind of powerful people in the middle part of the painting. And then the final part of the painting shows a prosperous Singapore never-ending. That then is translated into a poem and written in Chinese text. And we actually had him written both in Chinese and in English. There's an English translation beside that. But really the magic was how we then put that poem onto the platform floor. And it's actually cut into two pieces of granite. And it's actually like put together like a jigsaw puzzle along the entire length of the platform. Now, I don't speak Chinese, but the great thing about this is as you come into the station and you look down into the station onto the platform, you see the Chinese characters on the floor. And it gives you that I know where I am moment. I'm in Chinatown because it's the only station in Singapore, probably the only station in the world, that has massive, great big Chinese characters on the floor. And so it's that kind of integrated. We know it's going to be there permanently. But this is, again, go back to my talented colleagues, that the risk we had of not being able to technically do it, of being late, because if we didn't finish the artwork on time, the station couldn't open on time. So there's a lot of work that goes into this integrated approach. But that was just one station of the 16 on the line that just showed that very collaborative spirit that actually made the artwork happen.
Oh, I'd love to see that. That one sounds beautiful. Are there some others that you're particularly proud of in your illustrious career in Singapore?
The other one is at the other end of the island, at Punggol. So it's the original northern terminus of the station. And there we worked with an artist called Go Beng Kwan, very, very senior artist who did collage work, and he often would take newspapers, found papers, and do these amazing collages with painting over the top. And he came highly recommended, and we met with him several times, and he kept coming back with paper collage paintings. And I'm scratching my head going like, I can't put paper collages in a train station. They potentially could catch on fire. That's a safety risk. They will deteriorate over time. They will not last. And I was almost at a point where I was going to say thank you, but no thank you. I can't find a solution. When my art coordinator called me up and said, Andrew, I've met a guy who does slump glass. And I'm like, what is slump glass? I've never heard of this process. So we went off to this guy's studio and we took Beng Kwan with us. And I saw Beng Kwan's eyes light up. And this is an artist who's in his 70s, who saw a completely new opportunity to work in a completely new medium. So instead of working in paper, now he worked in glass collages. So he overlaid sheets of glass, sprinkles of glass, and he actually created his paintings now in glass for us. And those nine paintings are still in Punggol Station to this day. And if you get to Singapore, Mark, go up there to the north of the island, you'll be stunned by how beautiful these are.
Wow, they sound absolutely beautiful. I'm much looking forward to going there. And another place that you ended up working in, which I've still not unfortunately been to, is Dubai. When did you transfer there and what did you start working on next?
So in 2006, a colleague that I worked with originally in Toronto got himself a job as the project director for the Dubai Red and Green Lines. And he said, hey, I need a chief architect. I'd spent 10 years with the Land Transport Authority, a very happy time with them. And I just thought, well, this is an opportunity to do a brand new metro in a city that you just hear so much about, and an opportunity to do the first metro in the Middle East. So it's a real honor to be able to go over there. And I worked, again, on the client side, commissioning the architects, who are primarily led by ADIS over there, to do the 49 stations that we did through there. And they opened in 2009.
Hang on, 49 stations?
49 stations, yes.
Oh my goodness, that's a huge amount of work.
It was. Fortunately, most of the stations were above ground and we kind of cookie-cutted the design. But one of the interesting things about the design was getting it to what was called the Dubai standard. The original designs by the original architects were rather severe and austere, a bit like, for your UK listeners, a bit like the Jubilee Line stations. Dubai did not want Jubilee Line. In fact, their reference point was the Burj Al Arab, the famous seven-star hotel that sits on its own island, which from the outside looks like a very big white building. But when you go inside, it's a riot of colour. And I was taken to this building and said, right, this is what we want our metro to look like. And it's like, but this is a seven-star hotel. And I'm like, I had a sleepless night or two, and then I had a brainwave. I said, how do I do this? I called up some friends. I said, who was the interior designer for the Burj Al Arab? And she said, oh, Quan Chu. I got her number. I'll phone her up for you. And within a week, I'd hired Quan Chu Associates to become the interior designers for the Dubai Metro Red and Green Lines, and the rest is history. And you go there now and you see a series of stations that are truly like no other and that are truly befitting of the quality of Dubai as it sets itself across all of its projects, not just the metro, but you see across the buildings and the shopping centres, there is a certain Dubai quality that is unique in the world. And certainly it was a unique project in my career.
And unique and seven star, that sounds expensive.
Yes, it was. But again, I think you always got to look at these projects as being long-term investments in your city, right? You know, to save what sometimes is like several million dollars. But if you think about the economic benefit of a properly designed metro, a metro where people choose to go on it because it's a pleasant experience, not just riding on the trains, but going through pleasant stations, that pays it back multi times over through there. I always say to people that you've got to kind of set your design quality standard. Look at your history of your metros today and make sure that even when boom times, you don't drop down too bad. But particularly when economics are bad, don't cut your metro back, because you'll open it in a boom time and people look and say, well, why is it looking so cheap? So getting that balance right, getting it right for your city is really, really important. And of course, you've got to understand the cultural aesthetic references of the cities. You know, I mentioned earlier, Jubilee Line. I don't think the Jubilee Line would ever fit in Dubai at all, that approach of letting the structure be exposed. It's a very British approach to architecture.
You told us about some of the amazing work that you were able to commission in Dubai, and you brought some of those ideas forward when you joined the International Association of Transport Operators, didn't you? Tell us about your work with the UITP, please, Andrew.
So UITP is a Brussels-based NGO that promotes public transit globally, and they've been around for a very, very long time. And for 4 years, I was the chairman of their Design and Culture Committee, which brings together the chief architects and the art commissioners globally to talk about all things art and architecture in transit. And I think my role was really to be a catalyst for the conversation to go through, to showcase the different methodologies of commissioning art and good architecture around that, because none of this can happen unless you're working with talented artists and talented architects. And I've spent most of my career working on the client side, figuring out how to commission, how to create the environment for these talented people to do the very best work they can. And my personal ambition is always to be the best client that these people have ever worked with. And I hope the results globally in Singapore, Hong Kong, Dubai, and a little bit in Toronto have demonstrated that over the years, that I've inspired the talented people I work with to do their best work.
And do you think that the Design and Culture Committee of the UITP has helped to promote that message to other metros around the world who perhaps wouldn't have thought of the idea of including art and good architecture within their stations?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's often seen as being the cherry on the cake. And of course, when cost cutting comes around, what's the first thing you can cut? Of course, you can cut the art program. When I deal with the leaders of various metros I've done with, I say to them, the art program is not necessary. If you want to cut money, of course, you can cut it out. But when it comes down to opening, invariably, when the leaders come in, the first thing they'll get their picture done beside is the station artwork. And if that station artwork is really, really good and it's going to be there permanently, it is a showcase for their leadership, their vision for the metro, that they, this is their legacy. Of course, everyone expects the trains to run, the lights to come on, the air conditioner to work. That's part and parcel. But what they don't expect to go into a metro station is to see a world-class piece of art that actually represents the city to which it's serving. And that's the magic of art in transit done well.
We heard a few figures during the Transit Mapping Symposium about how much percentage of the investment in a metro system is given to things like art and design. And I believe that, you know, a huge amount of money obviously goes into safety and signalling and all those kind of things. But what's the kind of recommendation as to how much we should spend, or a good proportion of money that we should actually dedicate to art and architecture?
Well, famously, there's the 1% for art program in North America. And that's kind of where I started my career. And that was kind of like the genesis of the Toronto work. So there was this kind of federal requirement to actually invest in art. But actually, when you start to look at the economics of modern metros, if you spent 1% on art, you'd be spending hundreds of millions of dollars. It really would be a huge amount of money. And so it actually requires a very, very small percentage of the total cost of the total projects, typically between 0.2 and 0.4% of the total cost. And again, if you look at the overall cost, to say it's less than the cost of the signs in the stations, for instance. I mean, you can do many metrics through here. So it is very cost effective. Interestingly, where it is actually quite expensive is actually in the management time, because you've got to invest a lot in your artists. You've got to invest in a lot in the materials, in the making of that, getting the quality up. So I'd say there for any of the commissioners of art and architecture out there, be prepared to invest in the management of that and the quality materials, and then put it into the context of the big project that you're achieving, because that's really where the payoff comes off.
But it doesn't cost a fortune to make somewhere like that look good.
Absolutely not. And, you know, particularly say in Toronto, economy was the mother of necessity. We used just ordinary tiles, ceramic tiles, and we was going to pay for those anyway, because we needed to put tiles on the wall. So the cost of the art was literally screen printing the images onto the tiles themselves. Very, very small. And that's the beauty of doing it as an integrated program, is that most of the material cost is already a committed cost for the project anyway. So the cost of the art is only just a small uplift from that base cost.
Now, aside from your excellent work with the UITP, you then personally, with your own career, took a step back to another city that you knew so well.
Yeah, I went back to Singapore after 2 years in the desert. I'd finished designing the Dubai Metro. It hadn't finished construction at that point. But really, being a design manager, I think I described my career more as an architectural midwife. I was invited to go back to Singapore to work on the Downtown Line and the Thompson East Coast Lines in Singapore, which is a huge honour to be actually asked to go back to a previous career. And I took, interestingly, a lot of the lessons learned from Dubai back into Singapore. And if you see my later work in Singapore, you'll see a far more sophisticated approach to colour and texture, which were lessons from Quan Chu Associates and the Dubai Metro. I was far more bolder with our use of colour and pattern, and you'll see that in the later stations that you now see completed in Singapore.
And in the middle of the career, you were brought to this beautiful place, Hong Kong. Tell us about some of the things you were lucky enough to achieve here, please, Andrew.
Yeah, I joined MTR in 2013, at the time when they were doing a number of new extension projects. And again, given the timeline of these projects, I first of all got very heavily in the art program, because the architectural design had already been completed. So I commissioned 6 artists for the high-speed rail station here that connects to the mainland China, and also started doing the commissioning for the various stations that are already under construction. So it's a really kind of mixed bag. And in the background to that, starting to lay out the design rules for the new extensions, of new projects that are currently being built.
And do tell us about some of your favourite artworks here, because we've seen them and I want the public out there to hear some of your beautiful artworks and come and look at them.
All right, so again, I talked to you earlier about my favourite station. I'll be honest, I also have a favourite artwork, and it's here in Hong Kong. It's at Sai Ying Pun Station, which is a kind of suburban station right on the end of the Island Line here in Hong Kong, by a British artist called Louise Soloway Chan. Now, interestingly, I didn't commission Louise. Louise was already brought on board. But the location for her artwork, which is in a buried in one of the entrances, they decided to put it behind a bunch of lifts. No one could see the damn thing. And so the first thing I did was actually bring it into a much more public area. And Louise is interesting because she's a portrait painter by profession, as she went to college. But later on in her career, she went to India and she studied how to do three-dimensional reliefs. And she's done a series of bas relief paintings there that depict the local area in different seasons. And it's an absolute three-dimensional gem. I show it in many of the presentations, talks I did, even at the transit mapping talk. But a two-dimensional photograph doesn't do it justice. So any of your listeners are coming to Hong Kong, Sai Ying Pun, Exit B is the place to go.
And you can actually touch the artwork.
You can touch the artwork, take a selfie, and really kind of interact with it. And behind it are all the original sketches. I was so impressed with the work she'd done. All the sketches, prepared them. We printed them in black and white, and we surrounded the rest of those. So you actually see how she made it together with the actual pieces of the artwork.
Beautiful. And I understand you had something to do with dance, Andrew.
I've always been a huge fan of ballet, and I was very lucky to be approached by the Hong Kong Design Centre, where they were doing a conference here in association with the UK Design Council. And so I was invited, could I work with a UK artist to create an artwork for the MTR? The artist actually was a filmmaker, Jevon Chowdhury, and he'd done a series of video works where he has ballet dancers dancing in cities. And of course, it's very hard to do digital works in our stations. So I met with him, and his original plan was to fly over the Royal Ballet from London to Hong Kong. And I looked at my dollars and went, that's going to be very expensive. And I said, we've got a brilliant ballet company here in Hong Kong. So through my contacts, I reached out to them. And then we created a work for Wan Chai Station. Now, for people that know Wan Chai area of Hong Kong, it's historically a red light district. It's one of the nightlife entertainment areas through there. But you go in, it's one of our older stations, and it's very, very green. And people know their stations by their colours, but it's kind of bland. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to bring the vibrancy and energy of Hong Kong, of Wan Chai, deep underground. So that what we did is a series of photographs that we took primarily at night of the ballet dancers dancing through the city. And we pre-printed those onto the metal panels underground. So now, when you get off the train at Wan Chai, you feel the energy, the momentum of the Wan Chai district deep underground. And a bit like I was saying earlier about the Singapore Chinatown station, it's unmistakably Wan Chai. It can be nowhere else on the planet, let alone anywhere else in Hong Kong, that this particular image could exist. And I think it's a real great way of combining art with placemaking, with wayfinding, in a station that's been around for 40 odd years and now has got a new lease of life.
No one's going to know that they're not at that station.
Absolutely.
And even more recently, you've been pulled back to Dubai.
I have indeed. After 12 years here in Hong Kong as the chief architect with MTR, I was fortunate to be asked by Systra, the French multinational, to head up their design team on the Blue Line. And from a personal point of view, I'd been the chief architect on the client side for the Red and Green Lines. And this is the first time in my career I'm actually on the proper design side, making design decisions directly for the architectural team. And it's a real fun thing to be back into Dubai, which has changed so much in so many ways. Back with working with RTA, which is a fantastic client who's completely committed to delivering quality artwork and architecture, and you know, just having a great time.
We've just been to the incredible Transit Mapping Symposium. How important do you think it is for people in the same profession around the world to sit around and talk and examine and look at their work and try and get better artworks in terms of mapping, etc.? Do you think that we benefit from this, or is it just a talking shop?
I think it's a bit of both. I always say that these events are like preaching in the church of the converted. And what you normally get people is already enthusiasts, already experts. And sometimes when I do my presentations, I feel like Mick Jagger singing Start Me Up, because I've shown some of this work so many times over and over again. But the reality is that every time I go to any of these concerts, there's always something new to learn. There's always someone new to be inspired by. And so it's really kind of an opportunity to exchange ideas, meet new people, and see that you're not alone.
If a perfect world could be invented, how would you like to see future transit systems, or even re-equipping old transit systems, to look like from the point of view of the passenger walking around the station and getting their way round?
I think the best stations will be the most simple stations, and that's always the oxymoron, that we build metros in cities and it's getting more and more complicated. The stations typically get deeper, they're more integrated with existing developments, and they're part often of future developments. I always say to people, of the 200-odd stations that I've designed in my career, my favourite is Stadium Station in Singapore, designed by Woha Architects as part of an architectural competition we ran in about 2000. And the beauty of that is that there's an entrance, there's two escalators, they go straight down to the platform, and then you're on the train. And there's a skylight that runs the entire length of that. That's truly rare to get a site, an opportunity to do that kind of architecture. Most of it is a labyrinth of intersection because cities are so interconnected now. And I think, again, it's that variety of stations, that variety of cities, that is the true magic of transit. And then being able to kind of design these complex spaces, and the success of designing a station well, a really deep, complex station, is that people navigate their way around it seamlessly. Success is silent, failure is very loud. And in my industry, you know, we know when we fail because we see the crowds and we see people getting lost and everything else. And to see a project like that come together after many, many years of hard work by so many people, it's a joy just to come back to these stations and see them working them so well.
And that's a lovely way to end our discussion as well, because we remember that the very, very first underground line, they tried to do that trick you've just described of bringing lights down from the surface to the station platforms in 1863.
Yes, and you know, to carry on with that legacy, it's interesting we talk about legacy because the red and green lines in Dubai now are referred to as the legacy lines, and so I'm feeling like a bit of an old dinosaur. And knowing that I'm just a custodian, the first chief architect for Hong Kong, Roland Paletti, left me a fantastic legacy of stations. It has been an honour to look after those and build upon that legacy, and hopefully for the next chief architect to come along and build upon my legacy and continue to make these great cities better and better.
Beautiful. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on the Catchcast.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. Please come back and join us then.